stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Greek authorities say at least 28 migrants are drowned off the coast of Greece after their boat capsized today. Scores more were rescued from the southeastern Aegean Sea as would-be asylum seekers continue struggling to reach Europe. Meantime, German police say more than 12,000 refugees flooded into their southern hub city of Munich Saturday, with more streaming in today. These latest arrivals as tensions mount in Hungary ahead of the government's promised crackdown Tuesday on migrants crossing into Hungary from Serbia. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Budapest.
The steady flow of migrants into Hungary from Serbia may come to a sudden halt on Tuesday. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has promised tough action against anyone crossing the border illegally from that day onwards. Doing so could mean 3 years in prison. Trying to cut the newly erected fence could mean 5 years. Anyone entering Hungary will have to file for asylum. But first, they will have to prove they could not file for asylum in Serbia. The Hungarian Helsinki Committee Human Rights Group has called this a blanket authorization to reject 99% of asylum claims. The government has already moved several thousand soldiers to the border to bolster police already assigned there. Meanwhile, volunteers helping the migrants say they will continue their work. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Budapest.
A spokesman for South Sudan's President Salva Kiir says Mr. Kiir will address the nation Tuesday about the need to ensure a successful implementation of the ceasefire agreement. Both the government and rebels have traded accusations about who is responsible for violations of that accord. Security forces in Turkey today say at least three police officers are dead in the southeastern part of the country in fighting between police and Kurdish militants. Two officers were killed in a car bomb, and another police officer was killed in a rocket attack by the Kurdistan Workers' Party in provinces there. This is VOA News. Kurdish forces backed by airstrikes from the U.S.-led coalition have driven Islamic State militants out of nine villages in northern Iraq. More from Roger Wilkison.
Iraqi Kurdish fighters known as Peshmerga have successfully pushed the so-called Islamic State group's militants from parts of the northern Iraqi province of Kirkuk. The most recently liberated part is this village, where an IS flag can still be seen. The militants fled, but not before leaving roadside bombs to cause further destruction.
We have come to this village called Albu Muhammad and suffered from landmines which killed and wounded our fighters. If you look around, you will see that ISIS militants have left many explosives around us. Houses have also been destroyed.
Despite the militants' booby traps, which affect civilians and security forces alike, Peshmerga fighters are happy to be retaking their territory from the terrorist group. For Dilshad Anwar in Kirkuk, this is Roger Wilkison, VOA News.
Palestinians and Israeli police clashed at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem today, the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Fighting broke out after police entered the compound in pursuit of Palestinians who had earlier barricaded themselves inside and threw rocks at and flares at police. Israeli authorities used tear gas and stun grenades on the Palestinian youths involved. Jordan, which has custodial rights over the mosque, condemned the raid, accusing the Jewish state of provocations and attempt to change the status quo of one of the most sensitive sites in the Middle East. Saudi officials are pledging this year's Hajj will go ahead without delay, in spite of a crane collapse that killed 107 people and injured more than 230 at the Grand Mosque in Mecca. The huge crane crashed through a ceiling of the mosque as worshippers gathered on Friday for prayers. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland says sanctions against Russia for its role in the Ukraine crisis will remain in place until a long-violated truce agreement is fully honored. The Secretary Nuland said Saturday that Moscow will pay more costs for future violations of the Minsk Peace Accord.
If and when Minsk is fully implemented, including return of Ukraine's sovereignty of its border, we can begin to roll back some sanctions. But if Minsk is further violated, there will be more costs, and we will push with our European partners for that. And with regard to Crimea, sanctions stay in place on Crimea unless and until its sovereignty is returned to Ukraine.
Nuland spoke in the Ukraine capital of Kiev to a gathering of Ukrainian foreign and regional business dignitaries. At the U.S. Open tournament in New York, Italian Flavia Panetta has defeated countrywoman Roberta Vinci, who took out Serena Williams yesterday, also to take the women's title. Panetta beat Vinci 7-6, 6-2. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Plotter in Washington.
This is important to us because it is basically organized to mobilize the world in the level of heads of state and government to support the implementation of the peace agreement.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon invites South Sudan's rebel leader to a special summit on the sidelines of the upcoming UN General Assembly.
Socio-economic situation is getting worse in Chad here. And salaries are not often paid on time.
The U.S. Department of State warns citizens about the deteriorating security situation in Chad.
So we found that dams do have an impact on malaria because of the fact that they provide breeding habitat for mosquitoes and anopheles mosquitoes, which are the ones that carry malaria.
And a new study says people who live near large dams in Africa are four times likely to contract malaria. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian military reports that its increased pressure on Boko Haram is yielding results. This after some of the militants decided to surrender and stop attacking citizens. For more about this latest development, Colonel Sani Kukashika Usman, a spokesman for the military, joins us live via telephone link up from the capital, Abuja. Good evening, Colonel Usman.
Hi, Peter.
Well, Colonel,
good
evening to you. Tell me, what is this news we hear about the Boko Haram militants surrendering to the military?
Yeah, as you are quite aware, due to the new strategies being employed by the military, the Boko Haram terrorists have started surrendering. So the new offensive or the new strategies have started paying dividends in the sense that quite a number of them have started surrendering. And in addition to that, there is a total panic and disarray among the terrorists that they really wanted to surrender because we are gradually closing on to them and, you know, deny them freedom of movement, freedom of action.
So now that some of them have surrendered, what happens to them?
Yeah, actually, the good thing is that based on intelligence report and debriefing with some of them, they are quite aware that the radicalization program of the government will definitely be paying good dividends for them. So quite a number of them, really, those that are not deeply involved, will definitely benefit from that kind of thing. So, but beyond that, the course of law will take its course, regardless of the status of this terrorist and insurgency. But that notwithstanding, we will continue to do the best we could to ensure that we implement strategies, you know, to bring up the end to this Boko Haram terrorism and insurgency, and that does not preclude such other measures like the radicalization process that others will benefit also.
Talking about the end of Boko Haram, we had reports that there has been, you know, there have been twin bombings in neighboring Cameroon blamed on Boko Haram. So is the fight that you're taking to them having repercussions across your neighboring countries?
Naturally, it will have. Remember, even here in Nigeria, when the offensive was getting hotter, you know, they resort to all sort of, you know, devices, including targeting the otherwise called sub-targets, you know, raiding isolated communities and getting involved in suicide bombing. But the good thing is that there is a renewed effort and people are really now alive to their responsibilities because they are volunteering information and were able to preempt some of them before they act. And I'm so sure the neighboring Cameroon will definitely get over this aspect too. Most of the multinational task force is fully on board now.
Now, how how is this fight? Because President Muhammadu Buhari gave a directive that Boko Haram should be defeated in 3 months. Well, 2 months for now. So how, you know, specific is this fight to meet this directive from President Buhari?
Just like I told you, well, there are so many strategies that we have evolved, and part of it is the kind of, you know, the offensive action by both the Nigerian Air Force and the Nigerian Army, you know, routing them and blocking, their access to main supply or logistic supply, such as fuel, food, and other things, and further confining them to Sambisa Forest. And apart from that also, there is a renewed effort on the part of the society where they volunteered information. So wherever they are, you know, known to have inhabited, the troops go there to make sure that they dislodge them. There are so many other strategies that I don't want to disclose actually over the air.
Thank you very much. Colonel Sani Kukashika Usman is a spokesman for the Nigerian military. He spoke with us from the capital, Abuja. South Sudan rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar will attend a special meeting on South Sudan on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly on September 29th. This followed an invitation by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, according to Ambassador Ezekiel Lolgat, quote, the Foreign Affairs Secretary of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, in opposition. Gatkoth told me that the rebels expect the summit to help ensure the full implementation of the recently signed peace accord.
Well, we have received an invitation today from the Secretary General of the United Nations, His Excellency Ban Ki-moon. He is inviting His Excellency Dr. Riek Machar Teng. So we have received it today, inviting him to attend a summit, a special summit on South Sudan on the 29th of September 2015. And I can confirm to you that Dr. Machar will attend this summit. He will be leading a high-level delegation of the SPLM, SPLA, to attend this summit. And this summit is important to us because it is basically organized to mobilize the world in the level of heads of state and governments to support the implementation of the peace agreement, which was signed on the 17th by himself, Dr. Machar, and also by President Salva on the 26th of August.
What will be your expectations as you attend this meeting following the invitation of UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon?
Well, if you look at the history of the Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, he has been helping in the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan. And even in Sudan, when Sudan was still one, he was the one who worked together with others in the world to bring peace in Sudan and also witness South Sudan seceding as a new republic in the world. So now his involvement in ending this conflict, the 20-month conflict in South Sudan between us and the government, is a success story to him. Now he wanted to make sure that the UN is involved in the highest level by making sure that this summit is held in New York, and also the world leaders are attending this conference. So we will be achieving, the world supporting peace in South Sudan, two, mobilizing the world also to mobilize resources to reconstruct South Sudan, three, mobilizing the whole world also to help in resettlement of the IDPs and refugees in the neighboring countries and also internally in the inside the country. And of course, the recommitment to the world of the world to help South Sudan. We have fall off, but now with this agreement, we have gotten up and we are ready to walk and face the challenges of nation building and state building.
The security discussions between your group and representatives of the security establishment in Juba will hold talks in Addis Ababa. What are your expectations and what do you expect to achieve in these talks as part of the process of the full implementation of the peace by agreement?
Well, the workshop in Addis Ababa is starting today at 10 a.m. Our team has arrived from Pagak to Addis, and the government team, they have arrived, the generals from both sides. They are now in Addis Ababa, and they are starting the workshop today. One, the achievements that we are actually focusing on is to determine what kind of the army we wanted to have, because in the security arrangement, it's meant to establish a new army in South Sudan. This new army, the size, the composition, the training of it, and how the doctrines that you will use to instill into this army, this new army in the Republic of South Sudan, those objectives will be achieved. And then you will definitely have a joint forces in Juba, Presidential Guard, and also the Joint Integrated Unit will also be discussed in this security workshop. A holistic approach in trying to see what do you do with this new republic. Because what had gone wrong in this new republic, South Sudan, is institutional failures in the country. All the institutions failed, and that is why we went into the crisis. The leadership did not govern the country well. The army as an institution did not do well. The legislature didn't do well. The civil service and the security sector, all of them, they did not do what they were supposed to do. So a holistic approach in trying to look into this, into the security service, is intended to be achieved in that workshop.
Ambassador Ezekiel Lol Gatko is the Foreign Affairs Secretary of the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The government of Chad has yet to find a solution to poor economic conditions, which led to protests by public sector workers to demand for better working conditions. Patrice Idilta, a communications lecturer at the University of N'Djamena, says the prevailing situation is bad. This after the U.S. Department of State warned U.S. citizens against traveling to Chad and recommended that those in the West African country to leave as a result of the deteriorating security situation. Idilta told me earlier that the faltering economy coupled with the workers' agitations has resulted into security concerns, including the Chadian capital, N'Djamena.
Following the falling of the barrel price, socio-economical situation is getting worse in Chad here. And salaries are not often paid on time, and mainly these days, things are getting worse following the authorities' decisions to remove allowances paid to employees. And this decision led Union of Chadian Syndicates to observe 3 days of strike warning. This strike comes to an end yesterday and was widely followed by employees, but this displeases authorities who threaten employees for having observed it. So this led many people to be angry about this decision, and things are not really getting well these last days.
What has the government said about this so far?
For them, the situation is simply because, as I said before, economical situation is worse. And things will, let's say, be getting well once day. Because for the time being, the authorities are looking for help outside the country to help them pay salaries. And they will, for the time, they will try to cope with it instead of going against their decision. This is what displeased them, you know.
So what is the security situation there so far, and how are Chadians reacting to it?
Okay, the security situation, talking about Boko Haram, for the time being, you know, thanks to the authorities' decision to put a group of military, that is, people from militaries from Cameroon, Nigeria, and Benin, I think, Mali, and so on. I hope that people are looking at what will they will do, because for the time being, the situation is not so worse as what have been done before with Boko Haram killing people, you know.
How are Chadians reacting to the way the government is fighting Boko Haram?
The way they are fighting Boko Haram, yes. There was a decision taken by the legislature, which, in a way, was not well appreciated by people, because if someone goes on strike, it means he's against the authorities, and sometimes they try to mingle things, or they try to mix things up, talking about strike and Boko Haram, and there are reactions in the population about this decision, you know.
Has public sector workers talked about engaging or holding talks with the government to resolve this problem of workers' pay?
Yes, workers. Workers try to ask the government to remove, let's say, these decisions, which, let's say, avoid people to go on strike. Because if you go on strike, they consider you as someone who is against the authorities. They consider you as Boko Haram, part of Boko Haram. And employees and populations in general, they ask authorities to remove this decision. But unfortunately, you know, this decision was still on.
Patrice Ndilta is a communications lecturer at the University of N'Djamena. He spoke with me from the Chadian capital. Uganda's former prime minister has officially joined the opposition. This after Amama Mbabazi returned his presidential nomination forms for the Democratic Alliance or TDA candidacy. He now becomes eligible to be selected as the joint presidential candidate for TDA. Charles Mwanguhia Mpaji is the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda communications manager. Reporter Douglas Mpuga reached him in Kampala and asked him what this move means.
I think it indicates just that he is officially in the opposition. Though the construction of the Democratic Alliance is democracy-seeking institutions, at least that's what they have told us, is the premise of the foundation, bringing together members of opposition political parties, activists in civil society, and other like-minded people. But the ordinary interpretation, which I think would be the correct interpretation, would be that by rejecting to run under the National Resistance Movement and deciding to pick nomination forms from the TDA and seek its nomination, he's obviously going to run as an opposition candidate. Or he has indicated that he is an opposition candidate.
Does it mean then that Mr. Mbabazi also is in line with the Democratic Alliance's demand to government, giving them the government an ultimatum to consider electoral reforms before they announce their next move?
What we know for now is that he's been engaging the TDA in some debate. There are certain issues he has indicated he doesn't agree with the TDA, and the TDA has indicated there are certain minimum standards he must agree with. By seeking nomination forms, obviously, means that he has agreed to subject himself to the conditions, but that he's been having discussions behind the scenes with the TDA expressing his concerns. Means that possibly there is room for either of the two parties to make adjustments. Either he makes adjustments to agree with what they say are their demands, or they make adjustments to accommodate him. I look at it as an effort for accommodation on both sides.
Now, this TDA, the Democratic Alliance, the mere fact that it's managed to put together a former vice president, former prime minister, FDC's former president, Kizza Besigye, and most of the opposition, would that give them the clout to demand the reforms they are demanding from government?
That's not very clear at the moment. Yes, they have people, but the question is, how are the individuals or the groups coming together? What kind of base do they come with? The former prime minister, for example, is who does he come on board with from the government? If he manages to secure some key individuals to follow him into the TDA, that same applies to the former prime minister and the other people who have been there. The strongest member of TDA so far is the Forum for Democratic Change. It is not only the biggest opposition party, but it appears to be the most cohesive at the moment and most organized. The FDC will still tend to dominate the TDA, together with the former prime minister, because he's the freshest face in opposition politics. And apparently, either out of expectation or the recent rallies he has held in eastern Uganda, he seems to show that he has some amount of support. Whether that support translates into votes or into an actual following is something we'll wait to see. And that, obviously, will determine whether the push for electoral reform will gain the listening favor of the government.
How seriously is the government taking TDA?
To ask how seriously the government is taking TDA would be to miss the mark of our politics here. We'd rather say, how is the ruling party taking the TDA, and particularly President Yoweri Museveni. President Museveni doesn't take any opponent lightly. He tends to take his opponents rather seriously.
Charles Mwangu here. Mpaji is the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda communications manager. He spoke with reporter Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. A new study says people who live near large dams in sub-Saharan Africa are at least four times more likely to contract malaria. And it warns that with many new dams expected to be built in the region, malaria cases could rise by tens of thousands annually. VOA's Jody Kapwa has the story.
The study in Malaria Journal mapped the locations of nearly 1,270 existing dams and compared their locations with the incidence of malaria. It concludes that more than 1 million people in sub-Saharan Africa will contract malaria this year because they live near dams. Researcher Matthew McCartney of the International Water Management Institute is the co-author of the report.
So we found that dams do have an impact on malaria because of the fact that they provide breeding habitat for mosquitoes and Anopheles mosquitoes, which are the ones that carry malaria and are the hosts for malaria in people. The reservoir shorelines provide breeding habitat, and that therefore increases the number of mosquitoes around many, many reservoirs.
Dams create slow-moving or stagnant water, as well as shallow pools along shorelines. The study also considered the 78 major new dams being planned for sub-Saharan Africa.
There's a big push for socioeconomic development in sub-Saharan Africa, and a lot of that is centered around the construction of new dams.
If all are built, the number of new malaria cases could rise by 56,000 a year. McCartney says malaria risks should be considered in development plans.
We would argue that dam managers and planners and water resource development in general need to consider the fact that the infrastructure that they build has these impacts on malaria, and they need to do much more to try and mitigate these impacts.
The study makes a number of recommendations.
There are mitigation approaches, traditional approaches which center around treatment of malaria using bed nets, indoor residual spraying of people's homes. There are other things that can be done, such as modifying the water level within the reservoir where the mosquitoes breed. Those areas dry out and the mosquito larvae die at certain times of year. Another possibility is actually to use fish. A particular fish will eat the larvae of mosquitoes.
The greater malaria risk falls within 5 kilometers of a dam's perimeter. That's nearly the flying range of the mosquitoes carrying the Plasmodium falciparum parasites that cause malaria. The biggest risk is in so-called unstable areas, where malaria is seasonal due to the rainy seasons. But McCartney says large dams are not the only source of mosquito breeding areas.
For example, small reservoirs, ponds, tanks, natural wetlands, natural lakes. And so although the absolute number that we found is very high, it's quite small in comparison to the total malaria burden across Africa. This is in comparison to 145 million cases of malaria a year across the whole of sub-Saharan Africa.
McCartney describes dams as an important option for governments anxious to develop. However, he says it is unethical that people living close to them pay the price of that development through increased suffering and possibly loss of life due to disease. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, September 13th. All the four semi-finalists have now emerged in the 2015 African Champions League after the conclusion of day six matches this weekend. The semi-finalists are four-time champion TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Al Hilal of Sudan in Group A, as well as USM Alger of Algeria and Al Merrikh of Sudan in Group B. On Saturday, TP Mazembe beat Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco 5-0 in their final Group A match to finish on top of the group with 11 points. For its part, Al Hilal drew 1-1 with Smouha of Egypt to finish second on 9 points. In Group B, Al Merrikh defeated USM Alger by a lone goal to finish in second place on 13 points. Despite the defeat, the Algerian club finished on top of the group on 15 points. The semi-finals will be played over two legs, with the first leg slated for the weekend of September 25th to 27th, and the return leg for the weekend of October 2nd to 4th. In the last four, Al Merrikh will take on TP Mazembe, while Al Hilal will go against USM Alger. Turning to Africa's second-tier club football competition, the CAF Confederation Cup, all the four semi-finalists have also emerged. They are defending champion Al Ahly of Egypt and Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia in Group A, and Zamalek of Egypt and Orlando Pirates of South Africa in Group B. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Peres Jepchirchir on Saturday set a course record and a personal best time of 67 minutes and 17 seconds to win the women's title at the Matoni Usyn Nadlabem Half Marathon in the Czech Republic. A week after running the fastest 10 kilometers by a woman this year to win the Birel Prague Grand Prix, she improved the course record of 69 minutes and 38 seconds, set by compatriot Josephine Chepkwech in 2013 by over 2 minutes. In the men's event, Eritrea's Merhawi Kesete sprang a surprise when he won in 60 minutes and 58 seconds. The time is only 6 seconds outside Kesete's personal best. Kesete finished 1 second ahead of Kenyan's Baselios Kipyego. As I reported earlier, Kenyan Peres Jepchirchir won the women's event at the half marathon in 67 minutes and 17 seconds. After the race, the energetic Andy Edwards asked her if she expected to run that fast.
No, my plan was to run 68, yes, but I thank God because I've run 67.
Now you did that, from what I could see, without pacemakers. That's the way you like to race?
No, I was following time because I was told that if you run under 3:15, you're gonna run 68:30. So I used to follow that so that I can improve my time.
You said that the Olympic 10,000 meters is your target to get in the Kenyan team next year. What are you going to do?
Yes, now it's my target. Have that. This, I think this is my end. End season for the running half marathon. I'm gonna go back now to Kenya to prepare for 10K for next year Olympics. And God wills, if I can make it.
That was Kenyan runner Peres Jepchirchir speaking with Andy Edwards after winning the Matoni Usyn Nadlabem half marathon in the Czech Republic on Saturday. Turning to boxing news, American Floyd Mayweather Jr. has retired from boxing after beating Haitian American Andre Beto in a unanimous decision on Saturday night. The victory also ensured that Mayweather quit the stage on a clean note, tying the unbeaten 49-0 record of another American, Rocky Marciano. After the fight, Mayweather said, "You've got to know when it's time to hang it up, and it's my time to hang up. I've been in the sport 19 years and been a world champion for 18. I have nothing else to prove in the sport of boxing." Mayweather got a paycheck of $32 million for the fight. He made $250 million in May when he defeated Filipino Manny Pacquiao in what was billed as the fight of the year. Overall, Mayweather, who is 38 years old, has made $700 million in his career. Finally, defending champion Ghana has been eliminated from the All-Africa Games men's football tournament after Nigeria drew 1-1 with Senegal in their final Group B match on Saturday. Ghana's Black Meteors, who lost 2-0 to Nigeria in their opening match, were counting on the dream team to beat the Senegalese to advance. But the points seared means that both Nigeria and Senegal advanced from their group. Brazzaville, capital of Congo, is hosting the 2015 edition of the Multisport All-Africa Games, which started on September 4th and will run through September 19th. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Hey, hey, hey. Now I'm giving my testimony. So I'm using my sense to gather the properties. Okay, no time, like a statue of liberty. Nobody knows tomorrow, so I'll be holding my destiny. Yeah. As if it's in a jungle, some people they bubble. I continue the struggle, they double my hustle. As if it's in a jungle, some people they bubble. I continue the struggle, they double my hustle. Yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony. Oh, I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat. Oh, now I'm giving them everything. Oh, I'm living my life. I don't chop money. I don't taste money. Now my testimony, my testimony. I don't chop, I don't taste money. I don't taste money. Now my testimony, my testimony. I don't chop, I don't taste money. Je m'appelle Chop Money. Hey, it's good to be saving for rainy days. Not so, cause you know easy. Life is so delicate. Oh, oh. So make una see me as evidence. Baba God, mama confidence. Yes. His blessings are endless. Oh, as if he say na jungle. Some people they bubble. Hey. I continue the struggle. The struggle they double my hustle. Hey. As if he say na jungle. Some people they bubble. Hey. I continue the struggle. They double my hustle. Hey. Now I'm giving my testimony. I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat. So. Now I'm giving them everything. I'm living my life. I don't chop money. I don't taste money. Testimony, my testimony. I don't chop, I don't testimony. Hey. I don't testimony. Hey. Now my testimony, my testimony. I don't chop, I don't testimony. Hey. I don't testimony. Hey. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Hey. Okay. Je m'appelle Chop Money. As if he say na jungle. Some people they bubble. I continue the struggle. The struggle they double my hustle. As if he say na jungle. Some people they bubble. I continue the struggle. They double my hustle. Now I'm giving my testimony. I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat. Money. I don't taste money.
to make it for storm. When the cocoa master fall in love, you don't say what I don't pass, can. Hey! I'm in love. Are you in love?
Mama, you done make me fall in love. Fall in love. Fall in love. We fall in love because you done make me fall. Me fall in love.
Still it's a while for you, baby. Still it's a while for you.
cola, you can pull them. When I honey, now you can lay them. If me hat swam, now you sabi call them. Inside the bed, you sabi give me your campatan. And the 10 trouble come, you knocking pull on. And if I hungry, girl, you know they fall on. When I been there, don't get smooth to one. If you close your teeth, quick for a book come. And the tea rats, but take it back come. And the tea where I want, you can bring them. Girl, it's too funny, sweet, say you can't come. It's too straightforward, you know get pattern. Girl, you water, but I miss a big time. And girl, you water, but I miss a big time. I just wanna let you know, you're not the number one. They don't beat me for you. And they kill me for you. They even swear me for you. Still it's a while for you. They don't beat me for you. And they kill me for you. They even swear me for you. Still it's a while for you. Baby, I day out for you. Baby, still it's a while for you. Even if they rain. Say good woman, not the one like you, mama. But go there by you, where you under. It's dry, rice, curry, and sugar. Do what you want and complain later. Clean pocket, I no go busy but the hammer. If I want it, they go ready for Shia. When some can go ready for Bia. No go wear shorts and go tie lapa. No go make up, but show you real beauty. But she don't know, no go there for my party. I go protect you just like condom. Treat you right and build your mansion. The way we want you, tell them, then go sleep. And tell them, say we love, switch it down too deep. All my not send, I want no man I can keep. A pretty girl, when I you me, don't pick. They don't beat me for you. And they kill me for you. They even swear me for you. Still it's a while for you. They don't beat me for you. And they kill me for you. They even swear me for you. Still it's a while for you. Baby, I day out for you. Baby, still it's a while for you. Even if they rain. Life jackets, save you, bless call, I go make you sweat. Put smile on your face, you not go upset. Show you real love, what you not go regret. I only like one egg, you not go broke, me on. Put string on your finger, the left hand. Not go promise anything, I not go fulfill. I'm ready for go jail for you, sick, why go don't kill. For you, I not go keep two man, I just you. And I go make sure that I stick. I never regret the fact that I met you. Just wanna love you and not stress you. Go the extra mile, so just to please you. Guide you, control you, protect you. Don't go make other woman for my less you. Put it in a bag, girl, I go dress you. They don't beat me for you, and they kill me for you. They even swear me for you, still it's a while for you. They don't beat me for you, and they kill me for you. They even swear me for you, still it's a while for you. Baby, I day out for you. Baby, still it's a while for you. Even if they rain.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. We must return to the crisis of refugees and immigration in Europe. Although the European governments through the European Union are now attempting to tackle the issue, Europe remains divided. Countries like Germany, Sweden, and increasingly France are ready to tackle the problem. But those in Eastern Europe, led by Hungary, are bitterly opposed to any emigration or refugees. The President of the European Union last week set out quotas for all 28 European Union members, but this plan has been vigorously rejected by the countries of Eastern Europe. Now, when I last spoke about this issue, I raised a question, who speaks for Africa? And until now, there has been no announcement or pronouncement by the African Union or any African governments. Now, what has brought about some of the changes we are seeing in Europe? It was the sad picture of a three-year-old Syrian boy washed away on a Turkish beach that pricked the conscience of ordinary Europeans who began to put pressure on the government to do more about the immigration issue or refugees. In this connection, countries like the United Kingdom and its Prime Minister, who have been totally opposed to any increase of emigration in England, are to change course. The Prime Minister of Great Britain, Cameron, is now proposing for Britain to accept 20,000 emigrants in the course of the current parliament, which is 5 years. Germany says it would receive 800,000 and more for a long time to come. Now, the crucial issue we must bear in mind, and all Africans must bear in mind, that this change has not affected African emigrants or refugees. In fact, the European media has changed the debate from one of emigration and refugees to one of rescuing Syrian emigrants. So what they are now talking about is solely Syrian emigrants and refugees. Those Africans who have taken the dangerous journey are still languishing in camps in Italy or in Greece. The governments are not willing to accept African emigrants in Europe. And this reality must be borne in mind by every African who wants to make a desperate attempt to reach Europe. And you may ask why? Because there are political parties in Europe that are particularly opposed to African emigration. Luckily, Chancellor of Germany has been very clear in combating these right-wing forces. In France, in Sweden, in Denmark, we also have these right-wing parties. There is a hopeful sign, though. Just yesterday, in Britain, the Labour Party dared to elect a left-wing socialist as its new leader. And he has been clear that Britain must do more about emigration. And to make the point very clear, the European Union last week decided to establish a trust fund of $2 billion. They understand the mentality of African leaders. Even though none of them have spoken in favor or in support of African emigration to Europe or to protect them, they know that once there is a money trust fund, there will be a jockeying by African leaders to get their hands on those funds. But this is a very serious matter because there is obvious discrimination. Discrimination in favor of Syrian refugees and total rejection of African emigration to Europe. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, advice is a stranger. If he is welcome, he stays for the night. If not, he leaves the same day. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Somalia. Long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacks by a militant extremist group, has made many strides since completing its political transition in 2012. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are now signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's deepening relationship with it, the U.S. mission to Somalia began operations on September 8th. It is based within the United States Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and will be headed by a chargé d'affaires until President Obama appoints and the Senate confirms the next U.S. ambassador. It's a critical step towards normalizing the U.S.-Somalia bilateral relationship, since our recognition of the federal government of Somalia on January 13th, as announced by Secretary of State John Kerry on May 5th during his historic visit to Mogadishu. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then-growing instability, the United States conducted diplomacy on Somalia affairs based out of Nairobi. Over the past 5 years, U.S. officials began to travel more frequently into Somalia to conduct official business. When security conditions permit, it is envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in Mogadishu. While Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists Al-Shabaab have been weakened but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal test for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and international partners, but for its leaders to put their loyalties and differences behind them and commit to working together for the common good.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.